Good afternoon, Tri-States. This is Ken, back in the reader's seat after a rather long absence, and I am here today reading from the Thursday, March 4th, 2021 Telegraph Herald from Dubuque, and we will begin with our first piece at the top of the fold on the front page. Dubuque schools offer catch-up plans. Dubuque Community School leaders will offer their summer reading program free to all first graders this year to help them catch up on learning lost during the COVID-19 pandemic. We want to make sure that we will fill the biggest need first, and first graders we know is our biggest need area at this point. So that's where we have to go first, said Cindy Steffens, the district's executive director of elementary education. Steffens and other district leaders shared those plans and other ideas to remediate pandemic-related learning loss among elementary school students during a meeting of the school board's Educational Programs Policy Committee this week. A similar discussion on efforts aimed at secondary students is planned for next month. These kids have been through something unique, so we have to have a unique response, Superintendent Stan Reingans told board members. Steffens shared with board members data on the percentage of students in kindergarten through sixth grade who met benchmarks on the Formative Assessment System for Teachers, or FAST, Literacy Screener, when it was administered this winter. In each grade level, the percentage of students meeting benchmarks fell from the 2019-2020 winter test to the 2020-2021 winter test. Reingans noted that those students missed the spring of the 2019-2020 school year due to COVID-19 building closures, in addition to alternating in-person and remote learning days for the first part of the current year and dealing with increased absences and illnesses. There was a lot of things at play, he said. We'll try to figure that out. Most importantly, though, is what our response moving forward. One of the district officials' more definitive remediation plans is to invite all current first graders to participate in the Summer Reading Academy, which has historically served young students struggling with reading. District leaders have said some of the biggest pandemic-related learning gaps are among first graders who missed the end of their kindergarten year due to COVID-19 school shutdowns. Indeed, just 41% of first graders met benchmarks on the winter FAST assessment, the lowest rate among kindergarten through sixth graders. Steffens said this year's Summer Reading Academy will be held on mornings 5 days per week from July 6th to the 30th. There also will be one field trip each week on an afternoon, and officials are developing an incentive program to encourage students to attend. The key, really, is to get as many of the first graders into this program as possible, Reingans said. Steffens said district leaders are talking to community partners about possible afternoon programming. We know we are going to offer our first grade students summer academy. We're not sure about afternoons, she said. We will work with our partners around that and look at where we're at as far as the pandemic. Steffens also shared with the board members other ideas being discussed to help students catch up, though those plans are not finalized. One option being explored is to offer jumpstart days for current kindergarten students spending their entire year learning online before they start first grade in the fall. Students could attend those sessions and learn school routines such as lunch and playground rules. We want to make sure they go in feeling confident that they can do this in their school as a first grader, Steffens said. Officials also are exploring the possibility of offering some kind of a virtual learning over the summer for current second through fifth graders. That could give students opportunities to reinforce skills and touch base with teachers and could be structured to give students the flexibility to work on their own time. School board members had mixed responses to the idea of an online learning program. Reingans noted that such an offering, if officials proceed with it, would be one step of many over the coming year to help students catch up. It's making lots of difference and different opportunities available to our consumers, to our parents, and our students so that they can plug in as needed. We continue now with our second piece, A Life Remembered. Woman's Smile Illuminated Cave. And we have a picture of a woman standing in, obviously, a cave with some stalactites hanging down. And the caption reads, Julie Rubel began operating Crystal Lake Cave in 2013. Her parents owned and operated the cave beginning in 1978. And here is the piece. Julie Rubel's heart lay in the 3.5-mile cave that extended beneath her feet. It held potential, opportunities for growth and success that she sought to bring to fruition. Julie, 51, died unexpectedly on February 9th, leaving Crystal Lake Cave to the care of her daughters, Lexi and Kelsey Ramirez. The cave was her dream, said Lexi, 23. A Bellevue, Iowa native, Julie grew up on the family farm. She and her older brothers, Doug and Jeff, spent hours romping through the woods on the property and tunneling through stacks of hay bales in their red barn. As the youngest, she was both a troublemaker and wannabe leader, Doug said. Julie later attended University of Dubuque, graduating with a bachelor's degree in business administration and aviation management. She tried living in Los Angeles and Las Vegas for a time, but decided she preferred small-town living. Miners discovered Crystal Lake Cave in 1868, and it opened to the public by 1932. After passing through several families, Julie's late parents, Doris and James Rubel, purchased the property in 1978. My dad comes home one day and says to my mom, "Honey, what do you think about buying a cave?" Julie told the Telegraph Herald in a 2014 interview. And, of course, my mom was completely surprised by this. Doris managed Crystal Lake Cave for 34 years before Julie acquired it in 2013 and continued to invest in the business. The tourist attraction, located south of Dubuque off US 52, was open from May through October. She enjoyed learning about the backgrounds of her guests and from where they came. Julie added a gem mining sluice where visitors could pan for minerals and in 2016 launched wild spelunking tours. Keith Rahe, president and CEO of Travel Dubuque, said her investment adds to the depth in regards of what we have to offer here as a community. Julie and Crystal Lake Cave recently were approved as subjects of biographical record in Who's Who in America by the Marcus Publications Board. The cave also garnered an appearance on the reality television show Fireball Run, Big Country, filmed in Dubuque in 2017. After the COVID-19 pandemic shut most businesses down in 2020, Julie continued to offer private cave tours. Last summer, Julie hired Scott Lee, owner of Kronk Disc Golf, to install a 9-hole course on the property. "I would be out there working on the course, and if you didn't see her, you heard the 80s music come blaring," he said at Julie's funeral service. The windows were down in the Jeep. Julie flew over a hill as she drove across the property. "Hey, how you doing?" she would ask Scott. "Just got back from the farmer's market. Got you some bread." Julie could illuminate any cave with her smile and laughter, he said. Lexi and Kelsey spent their childhoods immersed in Crystal Lake Cave. "I grew up walking along on the tours and spelunking and going in holes where adults couldn't fit," Lexi said. "As soon as I was old enough, I was giving tours." Julie delved into its history and the science of the Driftless region's subterranean depths. Staff attended yearly classes with a local geologist. Lexi later was promoted to assistant manager and helped her mother select merchandise and souvenirs before the season began. When she was not working, Julie pampered herself with massages and manicures. She relished walking her Shishan dogs, Teddy and Nemo, eating out at Texas Roadhouse and Olive Garden, and playing Clue with her daughters. Clearly, "It's so hard to put into words the way we're feeling right now," Kelsey 20 said at Julie's funeral. "It's hard to put into words how much love we had for her." Julie's family recently announced their intention to reopen Crystal Lake Cave this spring. Lexi observed how Julie often assisted others, even strangers, without question. Her daughters have absorbed her sense of empathy. "You really have no idea what another person's situation might be," Lexi said. "You've always got to be understanding and caring with people for that reason." Our final front page piece is preceded by a large picture of two older gentlemen standing shoulder to shoulder, and the caption below it reads, "Al Rowell and Jim Wagner, co-founders of Veterans Freedom Center in Dubuque, say the facility will reopen on April 1st with COVID-19 safety measures in place. It has been closed for most of the past year due to the pandemic." And the article is, "Veterans Center to Reopen." Sam Schmelzer said he can't wait for his hangout to reopen. "It's going to be great," said Schmelzer, 72, of Asbury, Iowa. "I've been waiting a whole year." Schmelzer is among the thousands of local veterans who used to visit Veterans Freedom Center in Dubuque before the meeting place closed due to COVID-19 concerns. "The socialization part of the center is so important," Schmelzer said. Located at 2245 Kerper Boulevard, the center was founded in 2009 by Vietnam veterans Jim Wagner and Al Rowell. The nonprofit facility serves as a gathering place for veterans while also providing various services. The center has been closed for the better part of a year, only opening briefly on a couple of occasions before shutting down again over coronavirus safety concerns. "We closed because our area is so small and we have so many veterans with different ailments. A lot of them are elderly," Wagner said. "We were just afraid that if it started to spread in here, it could get to all of us. We felt it was safer just to shut the center down." The center plans to reopen April 1st with safety measures in place. Masks will be worn unless visitors are eating or drinking, according to center officials. Wagner said the reopening decision was made because of the progress in vaccinating older adults in the Dubuque area. As of Wednesday morning, Iowa health officials reported that more than 8,200 Dubuque County residents had been fully vaccinated against COVID-19, and all residents 65 and older are eligible to get a vaccine. "Absolutely. It makes a difference," he said. "A lot of our guys have gotten both shots." Wagner said the center drew more than 5,000 visitors from January 2019 to January 2020. "Before COVID-19, we were getting 30 a day," Wagner said of the weeks leading up to the pandemic's arrival. "On Wednesdays, we would have euchre games and we would get 50 on that day." When it closed, Schmelzer lost access to an important gathering place. "I just read a lot and did puzzles," he said of his time without the center. "I like the camaraderie of the center. We have a lot in common because we were all in the military." Even while it was closed, the center continued to accept donations of deposit cans and bottles. Rowell has spent part of the pandemic loading the cans and bottles into a trailer. Proceeds from the can donations help fund programs and services of the volunteer-run center. 7 days a week, I am down here with the cans," Rowell said. "The cans are keeping us going. We've still been helping vets as much as possible." Rowell said the center's reopening will help offset a common problem among many of the local veterans. "A lot of us have post-traumatic stress disorder," Rowell said. "Isolation is not a good thing for us. This center is the place to be able to interact." Wagner said he has fielded calls from veterans ready for the reopening. "For a lot of veterans, this is what they want to do," Wagner said. "There will be a lot of happy people." And we have an inset about the times. The Veterans Freedom Center will be open from 9 a.m. to 3:30 p.m., Monday through Friday, starting April 1st. Again, the center is located at 2245 Kerper Boulevard, and you may call 563-845-0034 for more information. That's 563-845-0034 for more information. And we have two more pieces from Dubuque on the inside page. The first one, owners, Dubuque Bar closing. The owners of the Wolfhound Bar in downtown Dubuque say it soon will be closed because its lease was not renewed by their landlord. The bar opened in April 2019 at 1103 Iowa Street, the former home of the Aragon Tap, after more than a year of remodeling. Co-owner Gretchen Hall Potter told the Telegraph Herald at the time that she was enthusiastic about the location. "There is a lot of walking traffic down here, and there's so much excitement," she said. But Tuesday afternoon, the bar owners took to social media to announce that it would have to close when their lease ends on Tuesday, March 9th. The Post lambasted what it called a heartless act of building owner Ken Lynn, informing them via text message the day before that he would not be renewing the lease. This led to an outpouring of outrage at the news and support for the bar owners. Lynn, who owns and operates the neighboring Oolong Asian Cuisine, initially told the Telegraph Herald on Wednesday that he would not comment until he spoke to the tenants. On Wednesday night, he declined to comment again via email, but he sent the Telegraph Herald a notice he had received from a lawyer as the landlord of 29 Designs LLC, the business name used by Hall, Potter, and Wolfhound co-owner and manager Marty Hess, regarding a $1,141 small claims court judgment against the bar owners for failure to pay a Dubuque contractor for work. Lynn also sent a screenshot of social media posts complaining about noise at the Wolfhound by neighborhood residents and dissatisfied guests of the establishment. Hess said Wednesday that he and Hall Potter were heartbroken by Lynn's decision on the lease. "We're open for not even a year, and then COVID-19 hits," he said. "We'd much rather have had him do this last March if he was going to. We went through all the different paperwork to stay above water. We see the light at the end of the tunnel, and then this happens." Hess said he and Hall Potter spent more than $100,000 on renovations at the Wolfhound prior to its opening. At the time of its opening, Hall Potter said they had constructed a new bar, booths and stage, installed televisions, and tore out plaster to reveal original brickwork. The bar's Facebook post also added redoing floors, adding two bathrooms, and making the building accessible to the list. The business also installed a garage door that can open out to the sidewalk, which became its most prominent feature, unique to the neighborhood. That, Hess said, was included in the lease and got the Wolfhound $4,000 off the price. He said Lynn also agreed to pay for a new heater. Otherwise, however, Hess and Hall Potter will be out their investments into the space, Hess said. Hess admitted to having been late on rent once or twice during the pandemic, but insisted the business was paid up now and had been for some time. And our update on COVID, no new local COVID-19 deaths, 21 new cases in Dubuque County. No new deaths were reported in the Telegraph Herald's 10-county coverage area between 5 p.m. Tuesday and 5 p.m. Wednesday. In Iowa, as of 5 p.m. Wednesday, Dubuque County had a 14-day positivity rate of 3.8%, while Clayton County was at 1.3%, Delaware County 1.2%, Jackson County 2.8%, and Jones County 1.8%. Iowa provided new county-level hospitalization data Wednesday. The figures as of Tuesday afternoon showed that 13 Dubuque County residents with COVID-19 were hospitalized, unchanged from Sunday data. Also hospitalized were two Jackson County residents, an increase of two, and one Jones County resident, unchanged from Sunday. No such residents of Clayton or Delaware counties were hospitalized as of Tuesday. As of 5 p.m. Wednesday, no local long-term care facilities were on the state's outbreak list. Statewide, Iowa reported 624 additional COVID-19 cases for a total of 337,686. The state reported 3 additional related deaths, so the toll rose to 5,501. As of 5 p.m. Wednesday, statewide, 350,218 residents had received one dose of COVID-19 vaccine and 196,084 were fully vaccinated. In a release Wednesday, Delaware County public officials stated they continue to receive 200 doses of the Moderna COVID-19 vaccine weekly. At this time, state health officials have not announced when county officials will receive an increased allotment of doses. But 100% of doses provided weekly have been distributed. Appointments are being scheduled for those age 65 and older, as well as those who fit in the categories recommended by the state. Individuals age 65 and older are selected at random from the county's waiting list and the regional family health patient population. To be added to the list, visit regmedctr.org/COVID-vaccine-waitlist, all one word. Again, regmedctr.org/COVID-vaccine-waitlist. Crawford County health officials announced due to an increased number of vaccinators and vaccine supply in the county, the COVID-19 vaccine waitlist will be opening up to individuals enrolled in Medicaid long-term care programs, 9/11 operators, utility and communications workers, and public transit workers at the end of this week. Proof of eligibility may be required for individuals belonging to eligible employment groups. To be added to the wait list, visit www.crawfordcountywi.org/health or call 608-326-0229. That was www.crawfordcountywi.org/health or call 608-326-0229. Crawford County officials also announced they received 186 doses of the Pfizer vaccine for first doses and 120 doses of the Pfizer vaccine for second doses this week. A free COVID-19 testing site will be open in Platteville on Friday, March 5th from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the National Guard Armory, 475 North Water Street. Appointments are not required, but visitors are encouraged to pre-register at register.covidconnect.wi.gov. That was register.covidconnect.wi.gov. Wisconsin reported 539 additional statewide cases as of 5 p.m. Wednesday, raising the state's total to 565,131. There were 18 additional deaths reported, raising the toll to 6,458. Wisconsin also reported 951,501 residents had received at least one dose of vaccine, 16.3% of the state's population. Statewide, Illinois reported an additional 2,104 cases, increasing the total to 1,191,520. The state reported 44 additional related deaths, increasing the toll to 20,626. Illinois also reported 1,087,361 residents had received the first dose of the vaccine and 906,490 were fully vaccinated. As of 5 p.m. Wednesday, 56,113 residents in the Telegraph-Herald's 10-county coverage area have had at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, 18.6% of the area's population. Now we turn to our opinion page, and today we have one of our regular guest writers offering the other view. This is Kurt Ulrich, a freelance writer who resides in rural Jackson County, and he has a book, The Iowa State Fair, is available from the University of Iowa Press. And today he writes, Getting Ready to Ride into Spring. Rural America. At first, I thought I was hearing a flock of chattering blackbirds or crows down in the woods behind my house, like they might be ticked off about something. So I walked slowly through the snow down the hillside until I came upon a wondrous sight, a dozen American bald eagles feeding off a deer carcass. Eagles have hung out here for decades, yet their tiny voices always surprise me. One expects large, commanding Darth Vader of the bird world voices, but alas, eagles fall into the same expectation category as Abraham Lincoln, whose voice was described as high-pitched, reedy, almost falsetto, not the voice one expects to hear offering a great address at Gettysburg, a voice that likely was heard only by the first few rows of listeners. Fortunately, a few of them paid attention. It has been an interesting couple of weeks. The other morning, I was up just before daybreak, and a softball-sized golden-orange moon was resting low in the western sky, just above the treetops, and I had to marvel at the magnificent lure of space. A day later, NASA safely, even delicately, landed a rover named Perseverance on the surface of the red planet Mars. Life on Mars can never equal the prose assigned to it by writer Ray Bradbury. So frankly, I wish we'd move on to some other place or spend the money on those we know to be alive here on Earth. After a lousy 2020, I have finally given in to old age in a very important way. I have mowed my lawn and the lawns of others with a push mower for the past 60 years, and I'm done. I'm exhausted. For a number of years, I even pushed an old unmotored reel mower. The neighbors thought me crazy. I expect they were correct. So this week, I took delivery of a brand new riding mower with, of all things, a cup holder. I've never driven a mower, so we'll see how it goes. Over the years, I'd occasionally see some very large person on a very small riding mower, and I'd unfairly and snarkily think, you'd weigh a lot less if you pushed a mower rather than rode one. I wish to apologize to my fellow mower riders for having such thoughts, as I have gained weight during the pandemic, and I, too, will be mounting a small riding mower, and let's be fair, I was wrong. I sometimes stumble across the line toward pettiness and smugness. Forgive me. We are still in the winter of our discontent, but take heart. The ice pack has faded, and Canada geese are once again on the move, stopping briefly on my pond before winging their way north. Pheasants up the road have increased their population. Coyotes still move past my bedroom window in the night, yipping, yapping, and sometimes keening, which has to be one of the truly sad sounds on earth. But it's entirely okay, because it's going to be a great spring. And if you drive by on the graveled path above my place, be sure to watch for a tired old guy on a lawn tractor. He'll be the one smiling, singing in full voice. Be sure to wave. I really like his writing. It is so succinct and prosaic. Well, now we have one letter to the editor. Iowans deserve better than GOP legislative measures. From Carmen Hernandez, Valentine Drive, Dubuque. Ronald Reagan said, the most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. Exactly how our measures the Republican majority in the Iowa legislature is advancing, helping citizens. Fast-tracking measures, changing the start of the absentee voting period, and the closing time for polling places, and the time provided to employees to vote are examples of a government restructuring procedures, not to protect voting rights, but to suppress them. I would challenge lawmakers to publicize the confirmed cases of voter fraud, those verified through investigation, that purportedly are the problem such laws are designed to fix. Only after these infractions are made public can such voter suppressive laws make sense. If cases of fraud cannot be produced and verified, then it is clear that the government is not here to help, but to harm. These lawmakers are ironically proving Reagan's dictum. Iowans deserve better. You are listening to the Friday, March 4th edition of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. This is Ken doing the reading, and we now turn our attention to the obituaries. Earl R. Brimeyer, Holy Cross. Earl R. Brimeyer, 82, of Holy Cross, beloved husband, father, and grandfather, passed away at home, surrounded by his family, on Monday, March 1st. Visitation will be held from 3 to 7 p.m. Thursday, March 4th, at Kramer Funeral Home in Holy Cross. Due to the ongoing pandemic, we ask those attending services for Earl, please wear a mask and social distance. Mass of Christian Burial will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, March 5th, at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church, North Buena Vista. Burial will be in the church cemetery. Reverend Marvin Breeze will officiate. Earl was born December 27th, 1938, the son of Fred, Fritz, and Hilda Schuschke Brimeyer. He was the 10th of 11 children and the youngest boy. At the age of 14, he quit school to help his dad with the family farm after all of his brothers enlisted in the military. On September 29, 1962, he married LaVon Schultz at the Holy Cross Church. Earl farmed in North Buena Vista for over 60 years, eventually selling the farm to his three sons. He also worked at the Dubuque Packing Company, Tyson's Farm and Home, and Walmart in Dubuque before retiring. Earl and his family received the Century Farm Family Farm Award at the Iowa State Fair in 2016. He was a member of Immaculate Conception Church in North Buena Vista, the Holy Cross Fire Association, and the Knights of Columbus. Earl was a dedicated husband and family man who loved nothing better than to be surrounded by his family and friends. He was very proud of his children and grandchildren, and it was his greatest pleasure to have everyone gather every Sunday afternoon to share jokes, stories, and LaVon's good food. Earl enjoyed playing cards, fishing, hunting, gambling, and doing seek and find puzzles. He was a jokester at heart, and all of his children and nieces and nephews can tell stories of how he used his sense of humor to even make farm work fun. He always had a joke to share and a smile on his face. Darlene M. Consett. Darlene M. Mama Consett, 82, of Dubuque, passed away Monday, March 1st, at home, surrounded by her loving family. Mass of Christian Burial will be at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, March 6th, at Church of the Nativity, and will be live-streamed on the Eaglehoff Siegert and Casper Funeral Home Facebook page. Reverend Andy Upa will officiate. Visitation will be from 3 to 7 p.m. Friday, March 5th, at Eaglehoff Siegert and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory, 2659 John F. Kennedy Road in Dubuque, where there will be a prayer service at 6:30. Interment will be in Mount Calvary Cemetery. Condolences and memories may be shared at www.eaglehoffsiegertcasper.com. Masks are required at the church and funeral home. Darlene was born October 7th, 1938, in Epworth, the daughter of Louis and Lucille Kramer Hanfeld. She married Ronald Consett on June 24th, 1961, at St. Patrick Catholic Church, Epworth. He preceded her in death on May 21st, 2003. Darlene was employed in housekeeping for Dubuque Community Schools, for the priests at Nativity Parish, and at Loras College. She loved fishing and camping at Lake Joy in Wisconsin. She was an avid country music fan and especially had a love of Conway Twitty's music. Darlene was a devoted grandmother who loved taking care of her grandkids. She was a mother figure to so many people and was known to all as Mama. James B. Bow. James B. Jim Bow, 76, of Stonehill Franciscan Services, 3485 Windsor Avenue, Dubuque, passed away on the evening of March 1st, 2021 at Stonehill in Dubuque. Massive Christian burial will be at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, March 6th at St. Joseph Key West Church with Reverend Rodney Allers officiating. Burial will follow in Highview Cemetery in Epworth, Iowa, with military honors accorded by American Legion Post 650 of Epworth. Visitation will be from 4 p.m. to 7 p.m. Friday, March 5th at Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road, where a wake service will be at 3:45 p.m. Please remember to wear your mask. Jim was born on January 14th, 1945, in Dubuque, the son of Edward and Hilda Roth Bowe. He graduated from Wallard High School, and on May 25th, 1979, he married Karen A. Bowe Odell at St. Patrick's Church in Epworth. He served in the United States Air Force as a repairman from 1963 to 1967. Jim worked at John Deere in Dubuque until his retirement. He was a member of St. Joseph's Church, Key West, and volunteered at Unity Point Finley Hospital in Dubuque for many years. He was always good-humored and cherished his time with his family and friends, reminiscing about all the shenanigans he got into. Jim always knew someone everywhere he went and would always make it a point to say hello. Jim enjoyed cars and motorcycles and loved visiting car shows, drag strips, and hill climbs. In his younger days, he was fond of his many fishing trips up north with his dad, brother, and friends. He took many trips with his wife, Karen, and loved just being out for a drive. He always took pleasure in his walks on Grandview and the flood wall. He enjoyed his weekly breakfast with his buddies, solving all the world's problems. Jim appreciated all the goodies from his sister Linda, enjoyed his phone calls with his brother Rick, and looked forward to his Saturday afternoon grabbing a beverage and a bite to eat with his brother Tom. In lieu of flowers, a James Bowe Memorial Fund will be established. Ronald G. Abing, Lancaster. Ronald Ronnie G. Abing, 63, of Lancaster, died Tuesday, March 2nd. A massive Christian burial will be held at noon on Saturday, March 6th at St. Clement Catholic Church in Lancaster, where family and friends may call from 9:30 a.m. until time of service. Private family burial will be held at a later date. Martin Schwartz Funeral Home of Lancaster is assisting the family. Gary R. Oates, Platteville. Gary R. Oates, 75, of Platteville, died Wednesday, February 24th. Funeral services will be held at noon on Saturday, March 6th at the Melby Funeral Home and Crematory in Platteville, where friends may call from 10 a.m. until the time of the service. Burial will be at Whig Cemetery. Melby Funeral Home and Crematory of Platteville is assisting the family. Lorraine L. Wand, Galena. Lorraine L. Wand, 89, of Galena, died on Wednesday, March 3rd at her home. Arrangements are pending at the Furlong Funeral Chapel, Galena. Alan J. Strang, Cascade. Alan J. Strang, in 91, of Stoughton, Wisconsin, formerly of Cascade, Iowa, passed away peacefully Tuesday 2nd at Stoughton Hospital in Stoughton, Wisconsin. He was born November 17, 1929, in Cascade, Iowa, son of Aloysius and Olivia Los Strang. He received his education from the Aquin Catholic School in Cascade. He was united in marriage to Elaine A. Morrison, June 30, 1959, at St. Peter's Catholic Church in Temple Hill, Iowa. She preceded him in death on August 11, 1989. On January 29, 1993, he was united in marriage to Evadine Meyer at St. Martin's Catholic Church in Cascade, Iowa. She preceded him in death on October 4, 2018. Alan was a veteran, having served in the United States Army from 1953 to 1955. He worked at John Deere Dubuque Works for 27 years until his retirement in September 1987. Alan was a good-hearted, fun-loving, practical joker who enjoyed making people laugh and smile. He was a man who enjoyed the simple things in life, such as playing cards, puttering in his garage, and sitting on his porch chatting with folks as they passed by. He was a member of St. Matthias Parish in Cascade and the Cascade American Legion Post 528. Visitation for Alan will be from 8 to 10 a.m. Friday, March 5th at St. Martin's Catholic Church in Cascade. Social distancing will be followed as recommended by federal and state guidelines. Face masks are required to attend the visitation. Anyone interested in sending memorials may send them to Rife Funeral Home. Attention, Alan Strang Family at P.O. Box 430, Cascade, Iowa 52033. Massive Christian burial for Alan will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, March 5th at St. Martin's Catholic Church in Cascade with Reverend Mark Osterhaus presiding. Burial will be held in Mount Olivet Cemetery in Key West with full military honors afforded by the Cascade American Legion Post number 528. Janice M. Heister Bernard. Janice Mary Kinsella Heister, 93, of Bernard, passed away peacefully Monday, February 28th at her home in Bernard. A visitation for Janice will be held from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, March 6th at the St. Patrick's Catholic Church in North Gary Owen, Iowa. Social distancing will be followed as recommended by federal and state guidelines. Face masks are required to attend the visitation, and please refrain from handshaking and hugs during this time. Anyone interested in sending memorials may send them to Rife Funeral Home. Attention, Janice Heister Family, P.O. Box 430, Cascade, Iowa 52033. A massive Christian burial for Janice will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, March 6th at St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Gary Owen, with Reverend Mark Osterhaus presiding. Burial will be held in the Assumption Cemetery in Silva Switch, rural Bernard, Iowa. She was born at home August 21st, 1927, at her family home near South Gary Owen, daughter of William and Margaret Redden Kinsella. She was a graduate of the class of 1945 from St. Patrick's Catholic High School in Gary Owen. On June 11th, 1945, she was united in marriage to John Heister at St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Gary Owen. Online condolences may be sent to the family at www.rifefuneralhomeinc.com. Walter Heisler, Bankston. Walter Heisler, 82, of Bankston, died Tuesday, March 2nd. Visitation will be held from 9 to 10:30 a.m. Saturday, March 6th at St. Clement Catholic Church in Bankston, where funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Burial will be in the church cemetery. Kramer Funeral Home of Dyersville is assisting the family. Joan M. Heights. Joan M. Heights, 84, of Dubuque, died Tuesday, March 2nd. Visitation will be held from 9:30 to 10:30 a.m. Monday, March 8th at St. Joseph Key West Church, where a funeral mass will be held at 10:30 a.m. Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road, is assisting the family. Bernard V. Rupp, Reway, Wisconsin. Bernard V. Rupp, 76, of Reway, died Tuesday, March 2nd. Funeral services will be held 2 p.m. Sunday, March 7th, Melby Funeral Home and Crematory in Platteville, where friends may call from noon until the time of the service. And we do have some new arrivals, or no, I should say some. We have one new arrival. We always want to welcome the new ones to our interesting planet this time. And from our births, we have one from Tuesday, March 2nd, McCarthy. Stephen and Samantha McCarthy of Dubuque, a boy at Southwest Health, Platteville, Wisconsin. We continue now with some of our tri-state news. We just have one piece here. Epworth man accused of injuring second woman. From Epworth. A man who authorities said stomped on a woman's face in Dubuque in January was arrested again Wednesday for allegedly beating a woman so badly that she required facial surgery in 2019. Kevin J. McGovern, 32, of Epworth, was arrested at 10:44 a.m. Wednesday at Dubuque Law Enforcement Center on a warrant charging willful injury causing serious injury, a felony, in relation to the 2019 incident. Court documents state that authorities met with Nancy C. Nesson on December 21, 2019, at Unity Point Health Finley Hospital after she arrived with injuries to her left eye and jaw that required surgery. At that time, she would not name the man who assaulted her because she feared for her life. On February 16, 2021, she told authorities that McGovern was her attacker. She reported that on December 21, 2019, she was at McGovern's residence in Epworth hanging out with him and his wife, Shekina, when McGovern became enraged and began arguing with his wife. Nesson tried to calm down McGovern, at which point he started punching her in the head, documents state. Nesson stated that McGovern came at her three separate times, assaulting her each time by striking her in the head, documents state. Nesson advised at one point McGovern threw both his wife, Shekina, and her down the stairs of the residence. He then came down the stairs and continued assaulting Nesson, she told authorities. She eventually was able to flee the residence. Nesson told investigators who assaulted her less than 1 month after McGovern was arrested on a different warrant charging willful injury causing serious injury. In that case, court documents state that McGovern assaulted Alicia K. Lombardi, 25, of Dubuque, at about 2:50 a.m. January 10th in the 200 block of Main Street. She was diagnosed with fractures of her face, sinus, nose, and eye socket, as well as injuries to her ear and nose. Documents state that Alicia A. Brandenburg drove Lombardi's vehicle to transport Lombardi, McGovern, and four other people to Platteville on January 9th, McGovern's birthday, and back to Dubuque early on January 10th. Documents state that Lombardi confronted McGovern near the intersection of West 1st and Main Street after he vomited in her car. A witness saw Lombardi take multiple swings at McGovern, who then walked north on Main. Brandenburg drove Lombardi up Main, where she got out near its intersection with West 2nd Street and approached McGovern again. The witness reported seeing Lombardi pepper spraying McGovern. McGovern then punched Lombardi two or three times, knocking her to the ground, documents state. He then stomped her in the face multiple times before running from the area. He has pleaded not guilty in that case. My goodness. And we have a piece from Epworth with a picture preceding it of some heavy equipment doing some digging and a man watching it. And it's business owner Dave Koss, and he's watching the demolition of a portion of his building at the corner of Main and North Center Avenue in Epworth. The article is Epworth Building Partially Razed for Commercial Residential Space. A historic building in downtown Epworth is being demolished and will be replaced with a new structure that will offer both commercial space and residential living. We had a fire in an apartment upstairs a year and a half ago, and it's pretty extensive damage, and with the structure, the foundation wasn't great, said Dave Koss, who owns the building. We decided to knock it down and put up a new structure. The fire destroyed the apartment unit and damaged businesses Heiberger Insurance, Cox Optical, Epworth TV and Satellite, and the Pizza Factory, which were all housed in the same building. The oldest section of the building, which is being torn down, has existed since at least 1900 and was once known as Maxwell's Store, said City Clerk Janet Berger. Two additional sections have been added onto the old building over the years. The middle section of the building, where Heiberger Insurance once operated, is being renovated into an apartment unit, Koss said. The space where the pizza factory sits will remain the same. The new addition will no longer be attached to the pizza factory, but will be located about 10 feet away. It's kind of sad to see an old building go down, but we are kind of excited about the new structure, he said. Koss said work to tear down the old building was delayed by the cold weather last month, but started this week. He hopes to have the new building ready for tenants to move in this summer. The new building, located on East Main Street, will include two commercial spaces, which will each be about 900 square feet, and a pair of 800 square foot upstairs apartment units, Koss said. I hope it brings a new look to town, he said. It will be one of the first buildings you'll see as you come into Epworth. I am sad to see the old building go because it was kind of a unique building, but sometimes you have to keep progressing. Berger said the city received a $100,000 grant from the Iowa Economic Development Authority under a state community catalyst building remediation program to put toward the project. Downtowns have long been a symbol of a community's economic viability, she said. This location is the heart of downtown and is a key factor because it is central to town. The mixed use is also an asset because both types will be attractive for our downtown. And we continue now with just a few last pieces of news in brief. $40 million community college measure okayed by voters, including in Dubuque, Jackson counties. Voters approved a $40 million bond measure Tuesday to expand Eastern Iowa Community College's programs, technologies, and facilities. The measure passed with more than 70% voter approval in an 8-county region, according to a press release issued by the college. The college's service area includes all of Clinton, Jackson, Muscatine, and Scott counties, and parts of Cedar, Dubuque, Johnson, and Louisa counties. Unofficial Jackson County election totals showed 1,792 votes for the measure compared to 1,200 against. Dubuque County votes were included in Jackson County's totals. College officials plan to use some funds to offer new programs at Clinton Community College Maquoketa Center, such as courses in computer numerical control, engineering technology, and information technology education. The center is next to Maquoketa High School. Dubuque schools postpone ACT exam amid technical issues. Technical issues prompted Dubuque Community School leaders to postpone their administration of the ACT exam to high school juniors, which was originally scheduled for Wednesday. Mark Burns, the district's executive director of secondary education, wrote in a message to families that officials ran into issues as they kicked off their inaugural Pave the Way testing day that kept them from starting the ACT. District leaders had offered the chance to take the college entrance exam to all juniors along with community college placement tests or the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery Test. Technology teams from the district, ACT, and Grand River Center, where the event was being held, investigated the issues but determined that they could not resolve them Wednesday in a way that would ensure a seamless testing experience for our students, Burns wrote. Officials were able to still administer the other tests. District officials plan to reschedule the ACT for a future date and will notify families as soon as possible with details. You have been listening to the Thursday, March 4th edition of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. It has been brought to you by IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. And I have been your reader, Ken. Again, finally trying to get back in the groove here after having been absent for some time. I will be reading again tomorrow, and I hope you will be listening. Have yourselves a wonderful day out there. Spring is on the way. It's on its way. It's coming. So have fun. Put a smile on your face and find some good every day. Till tomorrow, take care. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland and is used today around the world and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But when those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.